Chapter 2. Towards the end of that summer term, I received the last visit and grand remonstrance of my cousin Jasper. I was just free of the schools, having taken the last paper of history previous on the afternoon before. Jasper's subfusc suit and white tie proclaimed him still in the thick of it. He had, too, the exhausted but resentful air of one who fears he has failed to do himself full justice on the subject of Pindar's orphism. Duty alone had brought him to my rooms that afternoon at great inconvenience to himself and, as it happened, to me, who, when he caught me in the door, was on my way to make final arrangements about a dinner I was giving that evening. It was one of several parties designed to comfort Hardcastle, one of the tasks that had lately fallen to Sebastian and me, since, by leaving his car out, we had got him into grave trouble with the proctors. Jasper would not sit down. This was to be no cosy chat. He stood with his back to the fireplace and, in his own phrase, talked to me like an uncle. "I've tried to get in touch with you several times in the last week or two. In fact, I have the impression you're avoiding me. If that is so, Charles, I can't say I'm surprised. You may think it none of my business, but I feel a sense of responsibility. You know as well as I do that since your, well, since the war, your father has not been really in touch with things, lives in his own world. I don't want to sit back and see you making mistakes which a word in season might save you from. I expected you to make mistakes in your first year. We all do. I got in with some thoroughly objectionable OSCU men who ran a mission to hop pickers during the long vac. But you, my dear Charles, whether you realise it or not, have gone straight, hook, line and sinker into the very worst set in the university. You may think that, living in digs, I don't know what goes on in college, but I hear things. In fact, I hear all too much. I find that I've become a figure of mockery on your account at the dining club. There's that chap Sebastian Flight you seem inseparable from. He may be all right, I don't know. His brother Brideshead was a very sound fellow. But this friend of yours looks odd to me. Gets himself talked about. Of course, they're an odd family. The Marchmains have lived apart since the war, you know. An extraordinary thing. Everyone thought they were a devoted couple. Then he went off to France with his yeomanry and just never came back. It was as if he'd been killed. She's a Roman Catholic, so she can't get a divorce. Or won't, I expect. You can do anything at Rome with money, and they're enormously rich. Flight may be all right, but Anthony Blanche, now there's a man there's absolutely no excuse for. I don't particularly like him myself, I said. Well, he's always hanging round here, and the stiffer element in college don't like it. They can't stand him at the house. He was in Mercury again last night. None of these people you go about with pull any weight in their own colleges, and that's the real test. They think because they've got a lot of money to throw about, they can do anything. And that's another thing. I don't know what allowance my uncle makes you, but I don't mind betting you're spending double. All this, he said, including in a wide sweep of his hand the evidence of profligacy about him. It was true. My room had cast its austere winter garments and, by not very slow stages, assumed a richer wardrobe. Is that paid for? The box of 100 cabinet partagars on the sideboard. Or those? A dozen frivolous new books on the table. Or those? A Lalique decanter and glasses. Or that particularly noisome object? A human skull, lately purchased from the School of Medicine, which, resting in a bowl of roses, formed, at the moment, the chief decoration of my table. It bore the motto, Et in Arcadia Ego, inscribed on its forehead. Yes, I said, glad to be clear of one charge. I had to pay cash for the skull. You can't be doing any work. Not that that matters, particularly if you're making something of your career elsewhere. But are you? Have you spoken at the Union, or at any of the clubs? Are you connected with any of the magazines? Are you even making a position in the OUDS? And your clothes, continued my cousin. When you came up, I remember advising you to dress as you would in a country house. Your present get-up seems an unhappy compromise between the correct wear for a theatrical party in Maidenhead and a glee-singing competition in a garden suburb. And drink. No one minds a man getting tight once or twice a term. In fact, he ought to on certain occasions. But I hear you're constantly seen drunk in the middle of the afternoon. He paused, his duty discharged. Already the perplexities of the examination school were beginning to reassert themselves in his mind. I'm sorry, Jasper, I said. I know it must be embarrassing for you, but I happen to like this bad set. I like getting drunk at luncheon. And though I haven't yet spent quite double my allowance, I undoubtedly shall before the end of term. I usually have a glass of champagne about this time. Will you join me? So my cousin Jasper despaired, and I... and I learned later, wrote to his father on the subject of my excesses, who, in his turn, wrote to my father, who took no action or particular thought in the matter, partly because he had disliked my uncle for nearly 60 years, and partly because, as Jasper had said, he lived in his own world now since my mother's death. Thus, in broad outline, Jasper sketched the more prominent features of my first year. Some detail may be added on the same scale. I had committed myself earlier to spend the Easter vacation with Collins, and, though I would have broken my word without compunction and left my former friend friendless, had Sebastian made a sign, no sign was made. Accordingly, Collins and I spent several economical and instructive weeks together in Ravenna. A bleak wind blew from the Adriatic among those mighty tombs. In an hotel bedroom designed for a warmer season, I wrote long letters to Sebastian and called daily at the post office for his answers. There were two, each from a different address, neither giving any plain news of himself, for he wrote in a style of remote fantasy. Mummy and two attendant poets have 3 bad colds in the head, so I have come here. It is the feast of St. Nicodemus of Thyatira, who was martyred by having goatskin nailed to his pate, and is accordingly the patron saint of bald heads. Tell Collins, who I am sure will be bald before us. There are too many people here but one, praise heaven, has an ear trumpet, and that keeps me in good humour, and now I must try to catch a fish. It is too far to send it to you, so I will keep the backbone. Which left me fretful. Collins made notes for a little thesis, pointing out the inferiority of the original mosaics to their photographs. Here was planted the seed of what became his life's harvest. When, many years later, there appeared the first massive volume of his still unfinished work on Byzantine art, I was touched to find among 2 pages of polite preliminary acknowledgments of debt my own name. To Charles Ryder, with the aid of whose all-seeing eyes I first saw the mausoleum of Galla Placidia and San Vitale. I sometimes wonder whether, had it not been for Sebastian, I might have trodden the same path as Collins round the cultural water-wheel. My father in his youth sat for All Souls, and in a year of hot competition failed. Other successes and honours came his way later, but that early failure impressed itself on him, and through him on me, so that I came up with an ill-considered sense that there lay a proper and natural goal of the life of reason. I too should doubtless have failed, but having failed, I might perhaps have slipped into a less august academic life elsewhere. It is conceivable, but not, I believe, likely, for the hot spring of anarchy rose from depths where was no solid earth and burst into the sunlight, a rainbow in its cooling vapours, with a power the rocks could not repress. In the event, that Easter vacation formed a short stretch of level road in the precipitous descent of which Jasper warned me. Descent or ascent? It seems to me that I grew younger daily with each adult habit that I acquired. I had lived a lonely childhood, and a boyhood straitened by war and overshadowed by bereavement. To the hard bachelordom of English adolescence, the premature dignity and authority of the school system, I had added a sad and grim strain of my own. Now, that summer term with Sebastian, it seemed as though I was being given a brief spell of what I had never known, a happy childhood, and though its toys were silk shirts and liqueurs and cigars and its naughtiness high in the catalogue of grave sins, there was something of nursery freshness about us that fell little short of the joy of innocence. At the end of the term I took my first schools. It was necessary to pass if I was to remain at Oxford, and pass I did, after a week in which I forbade Sebastian my rooms and sat up to a late hour with iced black coffee and charcoal biscuits, cramming myself with the neglected texts. I remember no syllable of them now, but the other, more ancient lore which I acquired that term will be with me in one shape or another to my last hour. I like this bad set, and I like getting drunk at luncheon. That was enough then. Is more needed now? Looking back now, after 20 years, there is little I would have left undone, or done otherwise. I could match my cousin Jasper's gamecock maturity with the sturdier fowl. I could tell him that all the wickedness of that time was like the spirit they mix with the pure grape of the Douro, heady stuff full of dark ingredients. It at once enriched and retarded the whole process of adolescence, as the spirit checks the fermentation of the wine, renders it undrinkable, so that it must lie in the dark, year in, year out, until it is brought up at last fit for the table. I could tell him, too, that to know and love one other human being is the root of all wisdom. But I felt no need for these sophistries as I sat before my cousin, saw him, freed from his inconclusive struggle with Pindar, in his grey suit, his white tie, his scholar's gown. heard his grave tones, and all the time savoured the gillyflowers in full bloom under my windows. I had my secret and sure defence, like a talisman worn in the bosom, felt for in the moment of danger, found and firmly grasped. So I told him what was not in fact the truth, that I usually had a glass of champagne about that time, and asked him to join me. On the day after Jasper's grand remonstrance, I received another, in different terms and from an unexpected source. All the term I had been seeing rather more of Anthony Blanche than my liking for him warranted. I lived now among his friends, but our frequent meetings were more of his choosing than mine, for I held him in considerable awe. In years he was barely my senior, but he seemed then to be burdened with the experience of the wandering Jew. He was indeed a nomad of no nationality. An attempt had been made in his childhood to make an Englishman of him. He was 2 years at Eton, then in the middle of the war he had defied the submarines, rejoined his mother in the Argentine, and a clever and audacious schoolboy was added to the valet, the maid, the two chauffeurs, the Pekingese, and the second husband. Criss-cross about the world he travelled with them, waxing in wickedness like a Hogarthian page-boy. When peace came they returned to Europe, to hotels and furnished villas, spas, casinos, and bathing beaches. At the age of 15, for a wager, he was disguised as a girl and taken to play at the big table in the jockey club at Buenos Aires. He dined with Proust and Guide, and was on closer terms with Cocteau and Diaghilev. Fairbank sent him his novels with fervent inscriptions. He had aroused 3 irreconcilable feuds in Capri. By his own account, he had practised black art in Cefalù, and had been cured of drug-taking in California and of an Oedipus complex in Vienna. At times we all seemed children beside him. At most times, but not always, for there was a bluster and zest in Anthony which the rest of us had shed somewhere in our more leisured adolescence, on the playing field or in the schoolroom. His vices flourished less in the pursuit of pleasure than in the wish to shock, and in the midst of his polished exhibitions I was often reminded of an urchin I had once seen in Naples, capering derisively with obscene, unambiguous gestures before a party of English tourists. As he told the tale of his evening at the gaming table, one could see in the roll of his eye just how he had glanced, covertly, over the dwindling pile of chips at his stepfather's party. While we had been rolling one another in the mud at football and gorging ourselves with crumpets, Anthony had helped oil fading beauties on subtropical sands and had sipped his aperitif in smart little bars, so that the savage we had tamed was still rampant in him. He was cruel, too, in the wanton, insect-maiming manner of the very young, and fearless like a little boy, charging head down, small fists whirling at the school prefects. He asked me to dinner, and I was a little disconcerted to find that we were alone. "We are going to Tame," he said. "There's a delightful hotel there, which luckily doesn't appeal to the Bullingdon. We will drink Rhine wine, and imagine ourselves where? Not on a jaunt with Jorrocks, anyway, but first we will have our aperitif." At the George Bar, he ordered 4 Alexandra cocktails, please," ranged them before him with a loud "yum, yum," which drew every eye outraged upon him. "I expect you would prefer sherry, but, my dear Charles, you are not going to have sherry. Isn't this a delicious concoction? You don't like it? Then I will drink it for you. 1, 2, 3, 4. Down the red lane they go. How the students stare!" And he led me out to the waiting motor car. "I hope we shall find no undergraduates there. I am a little out of sympathy with them for the moment. You heard about their treatment of me on Thursday. It was too naughty. Luckily, I was wearing my oldest pyjamas, and it was an evening of oppressive heat, or I might have been seriously cross." Anthony had a habit of putting his face near one when he spoke. The sweet and creamy cocktail had tainted his breath. I leaned away from him in the corner of the hired car. "Picture me, my dear, alone and studious. I had just bought a rather forbidding book called Antic Hay, which I knew I must read before going to Garsington on Sunday, because everyone was bound to talk about it, and it's so banal saying you have not read the book of the moment if you haven't. The solution, I suppose, is not to go to Garsington, but that didn't occur to me until this moment. So, my dear, I had an omelette and a peach and a bottle of Vichy water, and put on my pyjamas and settled down to read. I must say my thoughts wandered, but I kept turning the pages and watching the light fade, which in Peckwater, my dear, is quite an experience. As darkness falls, the stone seems positively to decay under one's eyes. I was reminded of some of those leprous facades in the Vieux-Port at Marseille, until suddenly I was disturbed by such a bawling and caterwauling as you never heard, and there, down in the little piazza, I saw a mob of about 20 terrible young men. And do you know what they were chanting? We want Blanche! We want Blanche! In a kind of litany, such a public declaration. Well, I saw it was all up with Mr. Huxley for the evening, and I must say I had reached a point of tedium when any interruption was welcome. I was stirred by the bellows, but, do you know, the louder they shouted, the shyer they seemed. They kept saying, "Where's Boy? He's Boy Mulcaster's friend. Boy must bring him down. Of course you've met Boy. He's always popping in and out of dear Sebastian's rooms. He's everything we Dagos expect of an English lord, a great parti, I can assure you. All the young ladies in London are after him. He's very hoity-toity with them, I'm told. My dear, he's scared stiff. A great oaf, that's Mulcaster, and what's war, my dear, a cad. He came to Le Touquet at Easter, and in some extraordinary way I seemed to have asked him to stay. He lost some infinitesimal sum at cards, and as a result expected me to pay for all his treats. Well, Mulcaster was in this party. I could see his ungainly form shuffling about below and hear him saying, 'It's no good. He's out. Let's go back and have a drink.' So then I put my head out of the window and called to him, 'Good evening, Mulcaster, old sponge and toady. Are you lurking among the hobbledehoys? Have you come to repay me the 300 francs I lent you for the poor drab you picked up in the casino? It was a niggardly sum for her trouble, and what a trouble, Mulcaster. Come up and pay me, poor hooligan.' That, my dear, seemed to put a little life into them, and up the stairs they came, clattering. About six of them came into my room, the rest stood mouthing outside. My dear, they looked too extraordinary. They had been having one of their ridiculous club dinners, and they were all wearing coloured tailcoats, a sort of livery. 'My dears,' I said to them, 'you look like a lot of most disorderly footmen.' Then one of them, rather a juicy little piece, accused me of unnatural vices. 'My dear,' I said, 'I may be inverted, but I'm not insatiable. Come back when you are alone.' Then they began to blaspheme in a very shocking manner, and suddenly I too began to be annoyed. 'Really,' I thought, 'when I think of all the hullabaloo there was when I was 17, and the Duc de Vincennes, old Armand, of course, not Philippe, challenged me to a duel, for an affair of the heart, and very much more than the heart, I assure you, with the Duchess Stephanie, of course, not old Poppy. Now, to submit to impertinence from these pimply, tipsy virgins. Well, I gave up the light, bantering tone, and let myself be just a little offensive. Then they began saying, 'Get hold of him. Put him in Mercury. Now, as you know, I have two sculptures by Brancusi and several pretty things, and I did not want them to start getting rough. So I said, pacifically, "Dear sweet clodhoppers, if you knew anything of sexual psychology, you would know that nothing could give me keener pleasure than to be manhandled by you meaty boys. It would be an ecstasy of the very naughtiest kind. So if any of you wishes to be my partner in joy, come and seize me. If, on the other hand, you simply wish to satisfy some obscure and less easily classified libido and see me bathe, come with me quietly, dear louts, to the fountain.' Do you know, they all looked a little foolish at that. I walked down with them, and no one came within a yard of me. Then I got into the fountain, and, you know, it was really most refreshing. So I sported there a little and struck some attitudes until they turned about and walked sulkily home, and I heard Boy Mulcaster saying, 'Anyway, we did put him in Mercury.' You know, Charles, that is just what they'll be saying in 30 years' time, when they're all married to scraggy little women like hens, and have cretinous porcine sons like themselves getting drunk at the same club dinner. In the same coloured coats, they'll still say, when my name is mentioned, "We put him in Mercury one night," and their barnyard daughters will snigger and think their father was quite a dog in his day, and what a pity he's grown so dull. Oh, la fatigue du Nord!" It was not, I knew, the first time Antony had been ducked, but the incident seemed much on his mind, for he reverted to it again at dinner. Now, you can't imagine such an unpleasantness like that happening to Sebastian, can you? "No," I said, I could not. "No, Sebastian has charm." He held up his glass of hock to the candlelight and repeated, "Such charm. Do you know, I went round to call on Sebastian next day. I thought the tale of my evening's adventure might amuse him. And what do you think I found, besides, of course, his amusing toy bear? Mulcaster and two of his cronies of the night before. They looked very foolish, and Sebastian, as composed as Mrs.
Ponsonby de Tompkins in Punch, said, "You know Lord Mulcaster, of course," and the oaf said, "Oh, we just came to see how Aloysius was, for they find the toy bear just as amusing as we do, or, shall I hint, just a teeny bit more." So off they went, and I said, "Sebastian, do you realise that those sycophantic slugs insulted me last night, and but for the warmth of the water might have given me a severe cold?" And he said, "Poor things, I expect they were drunk. He has a kind word for everyone, you see. He has such charm." "I can see he has completely captivated you, my dear Charles. Well, I'm not surprised. Of course, you haven't known him as long as I have. I was at school with him. You wouldn't believe it, but in those days people used to say he was a little bitch. Just a few unkind boys who knew him well. Everyone in Pop liked him, of course, and all the masters. I expect it was really that they were jealous of him. He never seemed to get into trouble. The rest of us were constantly being beaten in the most savage way, on the most frivolous pretext, but never Sebastian. He was the only boy in my house who was never beaten at all. I can see him now, at the age of 15. He never had spots, you know. All the other boys were spotty. Boy Mulcaster was positively scrofulous, but not Sebastian. Or did he have one? Rather a stubborn one at the back of his neck, I think, now that he did. Narcissus with one pustule. He and I were both Catholics, so we used to go to Mass together. He used to spend such a time in the confessional, I used to wonder what he had to say, because he never did anything wrong. Never quite. At least, he never got punished. Perhaps he was just being charming through the grill. I left her under what is called a cloud, you know. I can't think why it is called that. It seemed to me a glare of unwelcome light. The process involved a series of harrowing interviews with Matuta. It was disconcerting to find how observant the mild old man proved to be, the things he knew about me which I thought no one, except possibly Sebastian, knew. It was a lesson never to trust mild old men, or charming schoolboys, which. Shall we have another bottle of this wine, or of something different? Something different, some bloody old Burgundy, eh? You see, Charles, I understand all your tastes. You must come to France with me and drink the wine. We will go at the vintage. I will take you to stay at the Vincennes. It is all made up with them now, and he has the finest wine in France, he and the Prince de Portanon. I will take you there too. I think they would amuse you, and of course they would love you. I want to introduce you to a lot of my friends. I have told Cocteau about you. He is all agog. You see, my dear Charles, you are that very rare thing, an artist. Oh, yes, you must not look bashful. Behind that cold, English, phlegmatic exterior, you are an artist. I have seen those little drawings you keep hidden away in your room. They are exquisite, and you, dear Charles, if you will understand me, are not exquisite, but not at all. Artists are not exquisite. I am. Sebastian, in a kind of way, is exquisite, but the artist is an eternal type, solid, purposeful, observant, and beneath it all, passionate, eh, Charles? But who recognises you? The other day I was speaking to Sebastian about you, and I said, "But you know Charles is an artist. He draws like a young Ingres." And you know what Sebastian said? "Yes, Aloysius draws very prettily too, but of course he's rather more modern. So charming, so amusing." Of course, those that have charm don't really need brains. Stephanie de Vincennes really tickled me 4 years ago. My dear, I even used the same coloured varnish for my toenails. I used her words and lit my cigarette in the same way and spoke with her tone on the telephone so that the Duke used to carry on long and intimate conversations with me, thinking that I was her. It was largely that which put his mind on pistol and sabres in such an old-fashioned manner. My stepfather thought it an excellent education for me. He thought it would make me grow out of what he calls my English habits. Poor man, he's very South American. I have never heard anyone speak an ill word of Stephanie except the Duke, and she, my dear, is positively cretinous. Antony had lost his slammer in the deep waters of his old romance. It came floating back to him momentarily, with the coffee and chartreuse. Real green chartreuse, made before the expulsion of the monks. There are 5 distinct tastes as it trickles over the tongue. It's like swallowing a spectrum. Do you wish Sebastian was with us? Of course you do. Do I? I wonder. How our thoughts do run on that little bundle of charm, to be sure. I think you must be mesmerizing me, Charles. I bring you here, at very considerable expense, my dear, simply to talk about myself, and I find I talk of no one except Sebastian. It's odd, because there's really no mystery about him, except how he came to be born of such a very sinister family. I forget if you know his family. I don't suppose he'll ever let you meet them. He's far too clever. They're quite gruesome. Do you ever feel there is something a teeny bit gruesome about Sebastian? No. Perhaps I imagine it. It's simply that he looks so like the rest of them sometimes. There's Brideshead, who's something archaic, out of a cave that's been sealed for centuries. He has the face as though an Aztec sculptor had attempted a portrait of Sebastian. He's a learned bigot, a ceremonious barbarian, a snowbound llama. Well, anything you like. And Julia? You know what she looks like. Who could help it? Her photograph appears as regularly in the illustrated papers as the advertisements for Beecham's pills. A face of flawless Florentine Quattrocento beauty. Almost anyone else with those looks would have been tempted to become artistic. Not Lady Julia. She's as smart as, well, as smart as Stephanie. Nothing greenery yallery about her. So gay, so correct, so unaffected. I wonder if she's incestuous. I doubt it. All she wants is power. There ought to be an inquisition especially set up to burn her. There's another sister, too, I believe, in the schoolroom. Nothing is known of her yet, except that her governess went mad and drowned herself not long ago. I'm sure she's abominable. So, you see, there was really very little left for poor Sebastian, except to be sweet and charming. It's when one gets to the parents that a bottomless pit opens. My dear, such a pair! How does Lady Marchmaine manage it? It is one of the questions of the age. You have seen her? Very, very beautiful. No artifice. Her hair just turning grey in elegant silvery streaks. No rouge, very pale, huge eyes. It is extraordinary how large those eyes look, and how the lids are veined blue, where anyone else would have touched them with a fingertip of paint. Pearls and a few great star-like jewels, heirlooms in ancient settings, a voice as quiet as a prayer, and as powerful. And Lord Marchmaine, well, a little fleshy perhaps, but very handsome. A magnifico, a voluptuary, Byronic, bored, infectiously slothful. Not at all the sort of man you would expect to see easily put down. And that Reinhardt nun, my dear, has destroyed him, but utterly. He daren't show his great purple face anywhere. He is the last historic, authentic case of someone being hounded out of society. Brideshead won't see him. The girls mayn't. Sebastian does, of course, because he's so charming. No one else goes near him. Why, last September, Lady Marchmaine was in Venice, staying at the Palazzo Foliere. To tell you the truth, she was just a teeny bit ridiculous in Venice. She never went near the Lido, of course, but she was always drifting about the canals in a gondola with Sir Adrian Porson. Such attitudes, my dear, like Madame Recamier. Once I passed them, and I caught the eye of the Foliere gondolier, whom, of course, I knew, and, my dear, he gave me such a wink. She came to all the parties in a sort of cocoon of gossamer, my dear, as though she were part of some Celtic play or a heroine from Maeterlinck. And she would go to church. Well, as you know, Venice is the one town in Italy where no one has ever gone to church. Anyway, she was rather a figure of fun that year, and then who should turn up in the Maltons' yacht but poor Lord Marchmaine? He'd taken a little palace there, but was he allowed in? Lord Malton put him and his valet in a dinghy, my dear, and transshipped him there and then into the steamer for Trieste. He hadn't even his mistress with him. It was her yearly holiday. No one ever knew how they heard Lady Marchmaine was there. And do you know, for a week, Lord Malton slunk about as if he was in disgrace. And he was in disgrace. The Principessa Foliere gave a ball, and Lord Malton was not asked, nor anyone from his yacht, even the Pagnoses. How does Lady Marchmaine do it? She has convinced the world that Lord Marchmaine is a monster. And what is the truth? They were married for 15 years or so, and then Lord Marchmaine went to the war. He never came back, but formed a connection with a highly talented dancer. There are 1,000 such cases. She refuses to divorce him because she is so pious. Well, there have been cases of that before. Usually it arouses sympathy for the adulterer. Not for Lord Marchmaine, though. You would think that the old reprobate had tortured her, stolen her patrimony, flung her out of doors, roasted, stuffed, and eaten her children, and gone frolicking about, wreathed in all the flowers of Sodom and Gomorrah, instead of, what, begetting 4 splendid children by her, handing over to her Bridesmead and the Marchmain House in St. James's, and all the money she can possibly want to spend, while he sits with a snowy shirt front at La Rue's, with a personable, middle-aged lady of the theatre in most conventional Edwardian style, and she, meanwhile, keeps a small gang of enslaved and emaciated prisoners for her exclusive enjoyment. She sucks their blood. You can see the tooth marks all over Adrian Porson's shoulders when he is bathing, and he, my dear, was the greatest, the only poet of our time. He's bled dry. There's nothing left of him. There are 5 or 6 others of all ages and sexes like wraiths following her around. They never escape once she's had her teeth into them. It's witchcraft. There's no other explanation. So, you see, we mustn't blame Sebastian if at times he seems a little insipid. But then, you don't blame him, do you, Charles? With that very murky background, what could he do except set up as being simple and charming, particularly as he isn't very well endowed in the top story? We couldn't claim that for him, could we, much as we love him? Tell me candidly, have you ever heard Sebastian say anything you have remembered for 5 minutes? You know, when I hear him talk, I am reminded of that in some ways nauseating picture of bubbles. Conversation should be like juggling. Up go the balls and the plates, up and over, in and out, good solid objects that glitter in the footlights and fall with a bang if you miss them. But when dear Sebastian speaks, it is like a little sphere of soap sud drifting off the end of an old clay pipe, anywhere, full of rainbow light for a second, and then thut, vanished, with nothing left at all, nothing. And then Anthony spoke of the proper experiences of an artist, of the appreciation and criticism and stimulus he should expect from his friends, of the hazards he should take in the pursuit of emotion, of one thing and another while I fell drowsy and let my mind wander a little. So we drove home, but his words, as we swung over Magdalen Bridge, recalled the central theme of our dinner. "Well, my dear, I've no doubt that first thing tomorrow you'll trot round to Sebastian and tell him everything I've said about him, and I will tell you 2 things. One, that it will make not the slightest difference to Sebastian's feelings for me, and secondly, my dear, and I beg you to remember this, though I have plainly bored you into a condition of coma, that he will immediately start talking about that amusing bear of his. Good night, sleep innocently." But I slept ill. Within an hour of tumbling drowsily to bed, I was awake again, thirsty, restless, hot and cold by turns, and unnaturally excited. I had drunk a lot, but neither the mixture, nor the chartreuse, nor the Mavrodaphne trifle, nor even the fact that I had sat immobile and almost silent throughout the evening instead of clearing the fumes, as we normally did, in puppyish romps and tumbles, explains the distress of that hag-ridden night. No dream distorted the images of the evening into horrific shapes. I lay awake and clear-headed. I repeated to myself Antony's words, catching his accent soundlessly and the stress and cadence of his speech, while under my closed lids I saw his pale, candle-lit face as it had fronted me across the dinner-table. Once, during the hours of darkness, I brought to light the drawings in my sitting-room and sat at the open window turning them over. Everything was black and dead still in the quadrangle. Only at the quarter hours the bells awoke and sang over the gables. I drank soda water and smoked and fretted until light began to break and with the rustle of a rising breeze turned me back to my bed. When I awoke, Lunt was at the open door. "I'll let you lie," he said. "I didn't think you'd be going to the corporate communion." "You were quite right. Most of the freshmen went, and quite a few second and third year men. It's all on account of the new chaplain. There was never corporate communion before, just holy communion for those that wanted it, and chapel and evening chapel." It was the last Sunday of term, the last of the year. As I went to my bath, the quad filled with gowned and surpliced undergraduates drifting from chapel to hall. As I came back, they were standing in groups, smoking. Jasper had bicycled in from his digs to be among them. I walked down the empty broad to breakfast, as I often did on Sundays, at a tea shop opposite Balliol. The air was full of bells from the surrounding spires, and the sun,
casting long shadows across the open spaces, dispelled the fears of night. The tea shop was hushed as a library. A few solitary men in bedroom slippers from Balliol and Trinity looked up as I entered, then turned back to their Sunday newspapers. I ate my scrambled eggs and bitter marmalade with the zest which in youth follows a restless night. I lit a cigarette and sat on, while one by one the Balliol and Trinity men paid their bills and shuffled away, slip-slop, across the green to their colleges. It was nearly 11 when I left, and during my walk I heard the change ringing cease and, all over town, give place to the single chime which warned the city that service was about to start. None but churchgoers seemed abroad that morning. Undergraduates and graduates and wives and tradespeople, walking with that unmistakable English church-going pace which eschewed equally both haste and idle sauntering, holding, bound in black lambskin and white celluloid, the liturgies of half a dozen conflicting sects, on their way to St. Barnabas, St. Columba, St. Aloysius, St. Mary's, Pusey House, Blackfriars, and heaven knows where besides, to restored Norman and revived Gothic, to travesties of Venice and Athens, all in the summer sunshine going to the temples of their race. Four proud infidels alone proclaimed their descent. Four Indians from the gates of Balliol, in freshly laundered white flannels and neatly pressed blazers, with snow-white turbans on their heads, and in their plump brown hands, bright cushions, a picnic basket, and the Plays Unpleasant of Bernard Shaw, making for the river. In the corn market, a party of tourists stood on the steps of the Clarendon Hotel, discussing a road map with their chauffeur, while opposite, through the venerable arch of the Golden Cross, I greeted a group of undergraduates from my college who had breakfasted there and now lingered with their pipes in the creeper-hung courtyard. A troop of Boy Scouts, church-bound too, bright with coloured ribbons and badges, loped past in unmilitary array. And at Carfax I met the mayor and corporation, in scarlet gowns and gold chains, preceded by wand-bearers and followed by no curious glances, in procession to the preaching at the city church. In St. Aldate's I passed a crocodile of choir boys in starched collars and peculiar caps, on their way to Tom Gate and the cathedral. So, through a world of piety, I made my way to Sebastian. He was out. I read the letters, none of them very revealing, that littered his writing-table, and scrutinised the invitation cards on his chimney-piece. There were no new additions. Then I read Lady into Fox until he returned. "I've been to Mass at the Old Palace," he said. "I haven't been all term, and Monsignor Bell asked me to dinner twice last week, and I know what that means. Mummy's been writing to him. So I sat bang in front, where he couldn't help seeing me, and absolutely shouted the Hail Marys at the end. So that's over. How was dinner with Antoine? What did you talk about?" Well, he did most of the talking. Tell me, did you know him at Eton? He was sacked my first half. I remember seeing him about. He always has been a noticeable figure. Did he go to church with you? I don't think so. Why? Has he met any of your family? Charles, how very peculiar you're being today. No, I don't suppose so. Not your mother at Venice? I believe she did say something about it. I forget what. I think she was staying with some Italian cousins of ours, the Folieres, and Anthony turned up with his family at the hotel, and there was some party the Folieres gave that they weren't asked to. I know Mummy said something about it when I told her he was a friend of mine. I can't think why he should want to go to a party at the Folieres. The Princess is so proud of her English blood that she talks of nothing else. Anyway, no one objected to Antoine. Much, I gather. It was his mother they thought difficult. And who is the Duchess of Vincennes? Poppy? Stephanie. You must ask Antoine that. He claims to have had an affair with her. Did he? I dare say. I think it's more or less compulsory at Cannes. Why all this interest? I just wanted to find out how much truth there was in what Antony said last night. I shouldn't think a word. That's his great charm. You may think it's charming. I think it's devilish. Do you know he spent the whole of yesterday evening trying to turn me against you and almost succeeded? Did he? How silly. Aloysius wouldn't approve of that at all, would you, you pompous old bear? And then Boy Mulcaster came into the room.